Good evening, good morning, wherever you are in the world. This is the live Q&A call for Road to Gold on Saturday, 16th of January, 2021. Hi, my name's Andy Rice, and you knew that already. And you also know that Hamish Wilcox is here to answer all your questions. Now, because this is version one of Road to Gold, we're opening it up chapter by chapter. So we have a special topic today of starting, which is something I'm really excited about. It's the first of what I call our decision-making chapters. We're also going to open up the floor to any other questions on any other of the 12 chapters of Road to Gold. So feel free to use the chat box, use it as much as you want, because the more you use that chat box, the more you will get your specific questions answered by Hamish or by some of our experts who we have on the call as well. Good morning, Hamish. Fantastic morning for you in New Zealand, and I am extremely envious of that.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. Nice to be here.
You sent me a picture of the sunrise. It looks like it's going to be a spectacular day. And of course, a lot of us are very aware of what the weather is like, even how hard the wind is blowing in Auckland from day to day, because we've had our eyes glued on the YouTube screen or wherever we've been watching the Prada Cup. So as usual, before we kick off into answering our participants' questions about starting, what have you observed about the Prada Cup, and specifically let's talk about the starting. How important has that been?
Well, it's been really exciting to have the whole event kick off. It's been, as you can see on the TV, it's been huge in New Zealand. In Auckland in particular, everybody's got out there, and the spectator fleets are bigger than we saw in the Christmas Cup, even though Team New Zealand's not sailing. So there's been a huge buy-in, and the local, obviously the local population's hugely happy with Ineos's performance, because, you know, they were down in the dumps, before Christmas, with their regatta there, and they've really turned it around, and they've received a huge amount of support locally for that effort.
We know historically that Ben Ainslie always kicks off his campaigns in a terrible way. Most of his Olympic regattas, he starts on the back foot with a disqualification or somewhere finishing near the back of the fleet. He's come out in the Prada Cup all guns blazing. So did he do his typical stumble before Christmas? Did he have to sort of get that out the way to bring out the best of Ben, who always seems to do well when he's got his back against the wall?
Yeah, it is quite typical of Ben. And I think, they probably thought this, if we're going to try anything, let's try it before Christmas. And there's probably a bit of that. And there's probably also a little bit of the fact that there's new stuff coming on and development going ahead. And I think they probably would have rolled the dice a little bit after Christmas and said, oh, look, we need to improve in a dozen or, even 20 different areas. And they just decided what they were and with their observations, and they've got some amazing people, and they just went about and made those changes. And I think the feeling I had listening to Ben is they've sort of rolled the dice and they've all landed the right way at the moment, and they've really made a jump, not just in what we knew was going to be their strong conditions, but also down the line, down in the light areas where as well.
One of the messages we try to get across in Road to Gold is that there is no such thing as a silver bullet, that development and the building of world-class speed is generally through hard work and testing one thing at a time. It seems like Ben has ignored that advice and he's pretty much thrown everything up in the air and hope that it all landed the right way. Is that what has happened, or was there more design to it than what appears to be from the outside?
Yeah, how would we know? Yeah, no, it seems like they have changed a lot of things in the right direction, and they had some good guidance. I mean, there was, good boats on the water. They could have a real close look at everybody on the water and see where their strengths were and then try to work out why. So I think, they've definitely done it as scientifically as they could, but I'm certain they must have changed more than one thing.
Now, I read in one of the reports, I think it was the first race between Ineos and the Americans, that Ineos looked from before the start like they were gunning for the right-hand side of the course. They thought it was windier on that side of the course. Terry Hutchinson and his team with American Magic seem happy to give up the right and they wanted the left. And one of the things that we talk about starting, we start talking about the day types, the three day types that you identify throughout the chapters that we're just coming on to. And it seems like there was a difference of opinion between the Brits and the Americans about where the best breeze was. Knowing what you know about the race course that day, where would you have picked and why?
Well, there's a really strong right track, you know, in particular at that time of day when they're starting. So, you know, there's no doubt about the right. It's just how do you get it? You know, can you get there from, you know, a tight to leeward start and get rid of the other guy and then sort of control him on the right boundary? Or, you know, do you do it the other way like Ineos decided and just live thin as long as you can to the boundary on the left and then be in a strong position heading towards the windier right side, which is what happened. And as it turned out, that was definitely the card to play. And it also seemed to me that they weren't short of a bit of speed. You know, maybe if that, you know, if American Magic had been quick enough, starting tight there to leeward, they could have gotten rid of Ben earlier and that might've played out a different way. So it was certainly a right dominated course, and Ben went on to really control the right throughout that race and gave them nothing.
Now, of what you've seen so far, very early days, I'm going to ask you this every week until we see the America's Cup. You as part of Emirates Team New Zealand, who's scaring you the most of these three challenger teams?
Well, they've all got their strengths and weaknesses. You know, you can clearly see that Luna Rossa is able to foil and manoeuvre at pretty low speeds. And so she's going to be, you know, quite a strong team in this marginal foiling. And it's a tricky, you know, there's a lot of days that can be marginal foiling in that course, preferred course area off North Head when it gets, you know, pretty light and at times there's holes forming around the course. So people that go in and being able to come out again on their foils is going to be a key part of the event. Luna Rossa I put up there in the lighter air. And then in the windier stuff, I would have thought American Magic were quite drilled and quite disciplined and looked like they were going to race well leading into the event. But they really have, so far, they've dropped the ball in that area. And, you know, Ben certainly rose to the occasion. As you say, he's sailed two very accurate races and manoeuvred well, you know, strategy solid, won the start both times and controlled from there.
And of course, the thing that the challengers have that you have less of is they're going to be more battle hardened. They're going through all the hardships of the Prada Cup and you are allowed to sail on the same race course when they're not competing, but it's sort of dancing with your grandmother, isn't it? You've sort of got to make it up by yourself. So how much of a disadvantage does that put you at?
Yeah, well, it is possible for us to get on the course and run through the whole routines with the race committee and receiving the race committee data and understanding how that whole mechanism works. So our routines are following the same routines as the challenges, which is the agreement we have to share that whatever course they're on. But we're not racing a serious opposition. You know, we're having to race, you know, ourselves in some sense, you know, whether it's, yeah, there's different ways we can do that. So it does still bring them, bring them a lot of practice. And of course, there's other ways that you can do ashore where you have the other tools on land where we can try a lot of things out that we're seeing, moves that we're seeing from the challenges we can rehearse to some extent. So yeah, there's certainly a lot we can do, and our focus is going to be on getting better at all that.
Sorry, we're just getting a bit of interference. Can you just, all of us, if we're not actually speaking, just make sure. I wonder, yes, thank you. I was just about to name and shame, but thank you for just muting yourselves. Thank you very much for that. Sorry, it was a little bit broken there. I've got a first question, actually. And yes, thank you for reminding me, Kevin, and nice to see you on the call again, Kevin. What was the cause of Team New Zealand's capsize recently?
Yeah, well, that boats are, you know, they're living on the edge, these boats, and there's no doubt about it. It's not going to be the first one we see, and it won't be the last. You know, you don't need to make a lot of mistakes before it goes wrong. And that, you know, we've watched American Magic, you know, get as close as you can get to tipping over, you know, two or three times in the last couple of weeks. And I think, you know, just a lot of things conspired there. You know, we ended up, you know, coming out with a really strong gust, and we were quite slow, you know, which we all know in a dinghy is not a good look. And then we got way too high as that quite strong hard-hitting puff arrived. And it was one of those days where it was incredibly turbulent. You know, we were prefrontal, and it was really, really unstable. So the puffs were, we're going to talk about these in later chapters, but the puffs were quite helicopter-like, quite, you know, quite vertical, and you know, really hard-hitting, unstable air mass, sort of rolling down on the water. So it was a combination of a lot of things, but mostly it was just a bad fumble.
Yeah, okay. Well, it was very spectacular, and it was amazing and very gratifying to hear that nobody was hurt, and the boat was pretty much unscathed as well. So great testament to how strongly these boats are built. And meanwhile, just a little mention for the Vendée Globe as well. I'm sure everyone on this call has some awareness of what's going on there, but that's shaping up to be the most exciting and unpredictable Vendée Globe ever. And I suppose if I was going to cheer for anybody, it might be Boris Herrmann, who potentially has the chance to become the first non-Frenchman to win the Vendée Globe, because he's going fast with his boat that's pretty much unscathed. What made me think of it was just how strong these AC75s are, Hamish, but how fragile these Imoca 60s can be when they have strikes with UFOs, with either man-made debris or with sea life. It's a game of chance that they're playing, and sort of a casino game as to whether you're lucky or unlucky enough to hit some underwater debris. But it's all shaping up to be a really exciting race there. Anyway, thank you very much. We will give lots of time for questions this evening. We've got some of our usual suspects. We've got Olympic champion Lily Zhu, I see, is with us on the call. And I see that we also have Santiago Lange, another Olympic champion. So, Santi, if you've got any problems you've got with your starting, please use the chat box, and we'll see if we can help you out. And you're also very welcome to come in, and well, we'd love to chat to people. So if you've got a question that you put in the chat box, if you then want to follow it up by actually coming live on the call, that's always our preference, and it will either be Hamish or one of other experts on the call. John Emmett and Lily Zhu, as you know, have really helped answer some of the questions about the single-handed hiking outboats for us, and Penny and Russ Clark have done a fantastic job, amongst many others, with helping us out with the double handers. And I see we've got other stars, Nasher, I'm assuming that's Nick Asher, a double 470 world champion, almost as good as you, Hamish. And Nasher, it might be interesting to get your thoughts on starting as well. Just a question from Mike Madge. Can Pete Burling's match racing skills meet up with the other skippers? So let's make this another question before we move on to the meat of starting, Hamish. But the lack of match racing practice of Pete Burling, I suppose, is the implication of that question. Is that an issue?
Yeah, well, it's interesting to watch what's going on the course area, and you can see that the match racing skills are pretty helpful in sort of instinctively knowing the moves and the counter moves. But even more important is the boat handling and maneuvering skills of each team. So they, you know, you've got to be able to send the boat and turn the boat where you want it, and stay on the foil. And that's really, really hard. And I would say that that's likely to play out as a bigger priority than the actual match racing skills. You know, you to be able to defend an attack, or to be able to initiate an attack at the right time, you actually have to be able to do it. And what we're seeing out there is that a lot of the boats are just, you know, making errors in terms of their boat handling, maneuvering skills, and coming off their foils or splashing down, and then the whole thing, you know, just plays out more as a boat handling, you know, evolves as a boat handling skill set. So I think, you know, we're certainly aware of how good those other teams are at match racing, and we're trying to accelerate that through tools we can use ashore, where you can go over and over and over a certain style of starting. But actually on the water, what you really need to do is to learn how to maneuver the boats in these sharper turns, and especially in marginal foiling and stronger winds, just making sure you stay up.
And the other three teams, yourselves and the Brits and the Italians, will be very aware of the fact that it seems like the Americans are the most vulnerable to being able to get back up on the foils once they're off the foils, and that must be a very difficult thing to be able to carry into their races, knowing that they're so vulnerable in that really important aspect to this foiling racing.
Yeah.
So let's dig into the starting itself. And I'm going to ask Santiago Langer if he has a particular favorite type of starting, because and then I also want everybody else to answer. If you've got a favorite kind of start, is it always starting at the pin? Is it always starting at the committee boat? Is it starting out the middle? Some people would say of me and the Musto Skiff, it's starting on port tack and trying to make that work even when it's not going to work. Most of us have a favorite type of start, so I don't want to preempt it. Some of you will know why I'm asking the question, because you've been through chapter 6, and others won't necessarily know. So hi Santi, thanks for joining us on the call.
Thank you very much, happy to be here. It's always very interesting to be in this part type of debates. It's you always learn something, for sure. So I'm here to learn something.
Well, if we can teach you something, we've certainly done our job. So let's see if we can do that. But Santi, firstly, where are you in the world?
I am at my house in Buenos Aires. We are training, but Ceci got injured 2 days ago, so we have a little break that gave me the chance to be in this call, which is important. And regarding your question, no, I don't have a favorite part. I have certainly one that which I don't like, which is winning the pin, because when it's put it, for example, Palma, that many times is left favored. I always question myself that many times a risky start is a sometimes safer start, because if you don't take the risk, then you end up in the middle of the fleet all the race, and then it's always you are always racing under pressure. So the committee start, it give you more opportunities. If you fail a pin and start, if you do it wrong, the penalty may be very expensive, and if you don't risk it, also it gets very expensive. Normally I like to be strong starting at the pin, and then in the fleets you have people that are good at it and then threaten, for us, we probably, Hamish, know Iker Martinez, when he sailed in Accra, he pushed so hard to win the pin that if you fight, you may then fighting only with him, and he's willing to get all the way to the fight. And if you don't fight him once in a while, he gets that, everyone in the fleet get afraid of him, and he end up winning that races, and you get ups. It's kind of not, it's a difficult challenge, and but it's a cool game, obviously. And
So Santi, you talk about Iker Martinez being very aggressive to try and win the pin. Would you say overall that was a successful strategy for him, or were there times when it just went so badly wrong that it wasn't worth taking the risk, in your view?
Iker Martinez is a very interesting guy to observe how he races, because he played hard. Probably is a guy that I have seen more jibe sets than, but he's such a great sailor that he comes back, in all these hard move. Sooner or later along the race or along the regatta, he get it right. And then you see doing things that are crazy for my way of sailing, but because he's so good and so committed to it and to his style, he put it together and then he win a series. And obviously when you analyze it, I said, I need to be more aggressive, but you need to have his personality to do it, I guess.
Okay, so that's interesting. So personality comes into starting. Now, can you remember what was your, well, you've told us what your least favorite start is. Can you tell me what your easiest kind of start used to be before you started committing yourself to learning how to start the other kind of approaches to the line?
Well, I like the start that you don't put all your money only at the start. I like to do the race. So I want to have a start that keep me in the race, you know? So it's only when it's a very favorite tack side of the course that you sometimes need to risk it at the start to make sure you are going that way. But in all of the rest of the conditions, shifty conditions, I like to have the opportunity to be able to tack and get in phase. And I don't care so much about where I'm starting. I just want to be in phase. And you know, as an old rule, you want to be in the top mark in the hunt. You don't want to be last or first by a long margin. It's just about to, you know, to trust yourself. And if you have done the process right and you are good along the course, you know that you can catch up. And so you risk what is necessary at the start, and then you play your game from there. And the important thing is, as another golden rule, not make big mistakes and be good at every aspect of the game so you can fight back.
Now, in fast boats like the NACRA 17 that you're campaigning at the moment, there is a strong option to start on port underneath the fleet. Or if you want to be really brave, do what Paul Koloff did at the Auckland World Championships and start in front of the fleet on port, which he managed to execute extremely well. But that seems to work and be increasingly popular in the skiff boats and in the catamarans to start on port. So how often will you try that?
As I said, I think you need to be in phase, and it pays to be in phase. And I have a funny story here that when I came back after the Olympic Games, everyone, the traditional sailors, were blaming to me and Ceci why we started on port at the final race of the Olympic Games. How the hell you are starting on port? And this is new sailing. The upwind is only 6 minutes, and attack in an Accra will be 20 meters. And so to have 20 meters, your nose, stick your nose out, is a big deal. And starting on port, as you said, is part of the game. Now we have seen Tita and Bandy that they are very good tacking. They improve the tacking, and then they are good at starting on port. And then they tack, even if we have to go left, they've been able to start on port, that do a good tack. And while the rest of the fleet is all stuck together, going half a knot slower, because we have about two boat lengths on the side of us, he is going full throttle with free wind. And then the loss of his tack, that now is instead of 20 meters, is 5 or 8 meters, he kills us. And so it's interesting to analyze all this and trying to improve where you need to catch the good guys.
So even at the Olympic level, you're observing patterns of behavior. You've talked about Iker Martinez and his aggression, and you've talked about Tita and Banti with their port tack start underneath the fleet. So that's what always amazes me is how we're very identifiable by certain starting patterns. And one of the things that I think Hamish has done really well in this chapter of Road to Gold is to lay out the reasons and the methods for being able to execute a good start for any day type scenario. So when you're planning out your day and you're looking at the weather, are you already sort of mapping out the kind of start that you're going to be doing as you're looking at the weather forecast?
Yeah, I think your default start is always going to be the in-phase start. And there's a lot of times which, you know, I've kind of loosely identified a tactical days where, you know, you really are just looking for some breathing space on the lifted tack, and you're trying, you know, to be as flexible as you can, you know, right to the last minute in order to sort of maneuver, make those final few maneuvers and be up, heads up the course, because the phasing it's not always regular. You know, you can get long phases, short phases, you can get, you know, quite a lot of range in terms of the the speed of the pressure on the water. Is it moving at the same speed as the wind, or is it moving much slower, in which case you have to dig deeper into a shift or a phase to have the full benefit. So there's a whole lot of characteristics around the wind that you need to apply to your start as well. And, you know, we gave some good examples in that, you know, that Meltemi in Athens Olympics is a, you know, good example. It's a changing, evolving day, you know, as it heats up and that whole Athens basin gets warmer and warmer, the turbulence becomes greater and greater. And, you know, the middle of the day, the hottest part, it's, you know, it's really tricky. You have, you know, surges of wind and you have, you know, helicopter puffs and you have everything in between. So you have to be a very heads up. And your start has to reflect that.
I've got a question here that was sent in before the call. This is from Alan Riley, who asks, how do you start well on a badly biased start line? I particularly have trouble with starting on a line which is badly biased to the pin port end. How can I improve my starting in this situation?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing is that you've got to look at bias in relation to the average wind direction. So the race committee's really made a mistake to have made a bias line against the average wind direction. So the first thing, you know, you're always contemplating is when you get out to the start line, is the start square to the average wind direction? And any kind of race committee officer worth his salt is going to make that line square to the average wind direction, or they'll default and make it square to the top mark, which should be square to the average wind direction. So if the line's incredibly biased to the pin, it's nearly always because the wind has shifted left, not necessarily permanently. Usually it's a temporary phase to the left. So when it's heavily biased to one end or the other, you know, your default position is to get as far that way as you can, but to avoid the real cluster, at the real circus that occurs right on the pin, and try to be able to execute almost a port tack start at the favoured end, so you're in phase.
Yeah, and how much do you think these opportunities change according to the speed of your boat? So Santi's talked about in fast boats the opportunities on port tack. I'm thinking the slower the boat, the harder those opportunities become, because tacking is a low tariff exercise in something like a laser. So a 470, for example, is sort of at the crossover. Can you still execute those kind of opportunities early on to port in a 470?
Yeah, you can in a 470 for sure. And I think, you know, there's tacking benefit in a 470, you know, quite a long way up the range. And every boat has a point in wind speed where your loss is greater because the wind is strong. And, you know, I'm talking dinghies here. Typically, you know, you can gain from a good tack and light air in a dinghy where you can roll. To some extent, you can use a kinetics to accelerate you forward. So we've often got ourselves out of bad situations with some good tacking early on. And you'll see that the good guys have that. You know, those good sailors have those maneuverabilities where their boat handling is so good, their tacking so strong, and their acceleration around the start is very, very, very good. So even if they pulled the trigger slightly behind the boat next to them, their acceleration skills are such that they've almost bridged that deficit from the get-go. So a lot of getting a good start is about your maneuverability, and it's training those, really drilling into those maneuvers in order to improve them.
So yeah, that comes back to some of the reasons why Rota Gold is structured in the order that it is. You've got to get your boat handling to a point where you can actually execute some of these starting strategies, because it's such an intrinsic part of what you can or can't achieve. And we've got a question about the slow boat handling from Sebastian, who's a 49er sailor in the UK. And he asks, can you give some advice on how to control the stalling on the boat up to 8 minutes prior to the gun? And I think what Sebastian's referring to is one of the observations I made in Road to Gold is what I saw on the coach boat in Miami, either this a year ago or the year before, boats lining up 8 minutes before and sort of drifting backwards so that they're in the right spot at start gun. So tell us about some of the skills required to do that sort of slow drift backwards.
Yeah, there's a lot of maneuverability skills required. And I think one of the other questions you've mentioned might be popping up is what do you do if you're just two boats? Drilling with two boats is, limited, and obviously drilling with one boat is even more frustrating. Less exciting. And I think when you're learning these maneuvers, obviously, actually focusing on your starting in a regatta is one of the best ways to really improve, and then spending your energy debriefing how you were doing on the starts in terms of what your performance in that area rather than the whole race if you want to improve. But look, jumping back a step, if you're two boats, one of the really good drills you can do is just to be fighting for an end. So, you've put two boys in the water and you fight for that end. And as Santi said, you fight to the end, you don't give up. It's interesting. I love the way he brought up those personalities because it's so true. You get better at starting and often it's really just how good are you mentally at just being determined to win, over another boat or over an area of the start line. And it gives you a certain amount of aura in the fleet. And the better you get at starting and the better your speed becomes and your maneuvering becomes, the more likely it is that you get more space. So it's almost an unfair thing. It's like the rich getting richer. Our society is, going in the Western world, is going that direction. In the starting world, it goes the same way. You get better at your speed, you get better at your maneuvers, you get better at starting, and then you get more space. And so you get better again.
And the other side of that coin, it reminds me of a funny story about a guy who says, I didn't think my starting was that good, but I keep on lining up next to the national champion. He's always next to me, so I must be doing something right. And then he reads an article in a magazine, and the national champion that he's talking about says, my starting strategy is always to find a lemon and start next to the lemon. And then the guy realized that he was that lemon. So it cuts both ways. The poor get poorer as well, unfortunately. But we're here on Road to Gold to help make sure that you are upwardly mobile, upwardly socially mobile, and that you will be one of the rich getting richer.
Now, finishing with that question of two boats, I mean, you can really fight for an end. And then what's a really good one to do, and we talked about it in that chapter, is it's any stage at all, an outside person, the coach, obviously, just blow a whistle. And then they've got to maneuver their way out of that obsession with the pin. And you don't even finish the start. You just blow the whistle at any point. And they've got to get to the other end of the line, the race committee boat end. And then they've got to start fighting for that end. And it's interesting how the battle begins right away, because the first boat arriving at that end is going to take the prime spot at the boat end. And they're going to be aiming to win that. And the other boat's going to be trying to get it off them. And then, when that battle becomes, evolves, and somebody, or it doesn't really matter, but there's a point where you blow the whistle again and they've got to accelerate, get out of their position, get to the other end and start battling for the pole position at the pin. So that's a good answer to the question that about what do you do with two boats on a starting drill.
So that one's for you, Alan. You sent us in two questions, so hopefully we've addressed both of them. Now I'm just going to bring in Richard Parslow, who wants to say something about course geometry. And I wonder, Hamish, if you go back with Richard in the 470, I'm imagining you might have been competing at similar times. Richard is a former Fireball world champion, I think I'm right in saying as well. Hi, Richard.
Oh, hi, Andy. A couple of things. It's funny as well that Santi mentioned Ica, because Ica was notoriously aggressive when I was coaching the GBR 49ers. He was ruling the world at that time. And he really worked that as well, like the champion dominance, like a boxer almost, when he turns up there, he's ruling, and if he wants that pin, he's going to fight you for it, and hyper-aggressive. And just one time I saw him at Hyères, and it was the first start of the day, so no black flag or anything. And he got to the pin a little bit early, and with 15 seconds to go, it wasn't light, it was like 15 knots, 15 seconds to go, he sheeted in, came round the pin, jibed, and then took the transoms of the other boats that started on starboard. but like a really tight jibe turn, you know, around the pin. And I was thinking, you know, there's not many people who would attempt that, you know, let alone get away with it. And as it happened, the start was recalled and everything, but I was like, you know, you see some people pull some stuff off, but he's impressive. But what I really wanted to say, and I'm sure Hamish will agree here, is one of your big decisions about affects where you want to start is the course geometry. And what Santi was saying about, I don't necessarily want to win the start, but I want to get racing. And it's a really big criterion in our decision-making when we're starting. And, you know, I'm talking about when I'm sailing with Laurie in the Etchells or a Dragon or with John in the Merlin. You're always thinking, which is the longer tack here? And if it's port, I definitely don't want to be held on starboard for too long out of the start, because now I'm in the corner before I know it. And that's, so the freedom of choice, if you like, after the start is a big factor, especially if you know you're going to have to get onto port early. Yeah. And another thing is, if in doubt, start by the boat, because then at least if you want to get on the other tack, you can. Whereas if you're down the pin and you want to get on the other tack, your options are very much more closed off.
Exactly. And speaking of the, thank you very much, Rich. But speaking of that course geometry, it's interesting to conceive too that even if it's square, those boats that are starting up the line are going to end up being more centered on the fleet immediately, because there's a lot of boats that haven't made a good start, have had to tack, like you said. And so options-wise or risk management-wise, you're always going to be more centered on the fleet by starting up the line towards the race committee boat. You know, you'll look over your shoulder in 2 or 3 minutes and find if you've made a good race committee boat start, you're probably pretty much centered on the fleet, and then you've got less risk right away. So, you know, if everything's sort of running pretty even, if we call it like ticks and boxes both ways, you're probably going to end up, you know, hedging towards the top of the line or the race committee end of the line just for that reason alone.
And that's almost regardless of the bias, unless the line's really biased. You know, your course decisions are going to be based more on where you want to do what you want to do next rather than how much you can gain by being closer to the favoured end.
Yeah, yeah.
And Richard, you've won the Etchells Europeans in the last 2 or 3 years, and you're very
excited. Yeah, I did 3 years ago, I think 2018. Yeah.
So how much do your starting strategies change in slow boats, in sort of water pushers, compared with boats capable of planing up wind?
Well, overall, in terms of your race strategy, not that different, but I mean, there's a big difference, even in the water pushes, there's a big difference between the Dragon and the Etchells. You know, the Dragon takes forever to accelerate, but it keeps on trucking once it has. And the Etchells, much quicker to accelerate compared to the Dragon. So you wouldn't be doing so many port tack starts just to save a tack, put it that yeah. way. Right. And it was great hearing Santi say that about saving the tack as well, because that was a big thing in the 18 footers, especially when they came over to Britain and did the short course racing. Because, yeah. the tack is so expensive in the 18 footer, almost as expensive as in a cat. And, you know, there were quite a few people just lining up and doing a port tacker, going out to the starboard lay line and tacking.
Great. Well, Richard, thank you very much. And yes, that sort of proportion of the penalty of attack compared with the speed of your boat in a straight line, I guess, is always a big consideration, isn't it, Hamish, in terms of your tactical considerations, both at the start and around the race course.
Yeah, exactly.
We've got some nice questions coming in. We've got one from Dominic, which actually is similar to one that Silke sent in advance. So I'll start with Silke's, but it's the broad theme is about sort of carving out your space to leeward. Silke's question is specifically about J70 racing in fleets of six in the Sailing Champions League. So how do you create space to leeward if you have to be closer to the leeward boat to not open up a gap too early and risk other boats going in there, which has some similarities with Dominic's question in the chat box? How would you protect the space to leeward? should it be kept quite small to avoid those hunting for a whole space? So that's a great question. How big is too big a space?
Yeah, and I think it's a lot to do with those bigger boats. You know, they've got a lot of weight to them, and you know, you can't be too slow. We were recently doing an over winter training camp here in Auckland with the America's Cup and the New Zealand sailing team combined in these small sports boats, which still weigh a number of tons. And we were focused was on starting. And I remember we had Ray Davies and John Cutler and a number of others introducing their favorite start to the group in the classroom before we went on the water to put it in practice. And the interesting thing was that we also had Pete Burling talk about his favorite start, and we had a number of other dinghy sailors talk about their favorite starts, you know, from the New Zealand sailing team. And that whiteboard session went on during the morning, and then in the afternoon we went out on the water and we mixed the groups of sailors up so they could learn off each other. And Ray Davies definitely, you know, and John Cutler, their starting style definitely rewarded these heavier, even though were sports boats that were still, you know, a number of tons, you know, just keeping the boat moving. You know, you could see the dinghy sailors were, you know, were always inclined to get to the line and stop and then try to accelerate from that position, whereas their default was sort of a port tack approach. Was quite typical. Remember, we had about 10 boats at this, 10 of those Elliott squadron boats, match racing boats, and tack, you know, looking at the line and setting up on a time on distance and starboard tack, you know, was Ray Davies' preferred option. And then just killing speed towards the line, you know, not so you're going to get jammed out at the committee boat, not so you were, you know, too far down the line, but sort of in a position, as Richard talked, where you could still clear your air if you wanted to. And typically that kind of racing is really about managing a start that will give you a good lane. Because remember, the boats that win will arrive at the top mark, if everyone's in phase, and it's likely half the fleet will be those that have been able to have a bit more breathing space. Their lanes are a little bit bigger, and you know, they're able to therefore be going at their best BMG, as opposed to somebody who's a little compromised, a little thin in a lane and compromised with their BMG.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. So let's come on to this way. Oh, well, actually, quick follow-on question to that. Obvious follow-on question. Everyone else is wondering too, what's Pete Burling's favourite kind of start?
Well, I mean, he prides himself on starting well at the pin, and yeah, he'll take on anyone for that if he has to. But Pete's always thinking, you know, it's always what's going to happen next. You know, if you have to, the reason you win the pin is because you really have to go left. And as Santi said, there's a lot of venues where, you know, you're not in the money if you aren't on the left side, and you've got to find a way to be there. And it's more risk not to take the risk at the start, because if you don't manage to get to the left side of the track, then you know, you're going to be buried as well. So your problems are the same either way. So it's, you might as well just take it on and win the pin. And Pete's not afraid of doing that. And I think, you know, he's pretty happy at the boat end as well. I often see him right at the committee boat, but he's pretty happy near the boat, you know, making sure that he's going to be out of the blocks as well as anyone. So, you know, there's always risk at an end, because if the group goes over and you're with them, you're much more likely to be seen. You know, so you need to be able to start well in the middle, and that's kind of a good default position for a lot of good sailors. Will do that, start somewhere between a third down and two thirds down the line if everything's the same, and that allows them to manage the whole risk of being seen early from an end, and also be able to get in phase.
Well, that makes me think that actually one way that you can analyse what people are doing is to use the tracking data that's out there, the SAP sailing analytics for a start, and all the events that they've covered. And I'm thinking that maybe Matt Belcher and Will Ryan are one of those sort of middle of the start kind of competitors, because they tend to race up the middle of the racetrack and rely on speed. And I wonder if Nick Asher wants to comment on that, because he, and also to know what Nick's favourite starting might have been in his 470 days. So if you want to come in on that, Nick, it'd be quite interesting. But let me just ask you about this question of creating and protecting space to Lourdes, the question from Dominic and from Silke Hamish. So just give us some input on that.
Yeah, well, that could be a good one to pass on to Nick. I mean, yeah, Nash is a really good, you know, starter and a really solid racer tactically. So it'd be really interesting to hear if he's ready to come on. We'll get him on that. But are you there, Nick?
Well, let's see if he does come in. And I also want to make sure, I want to ask Mara Dewey, who's one of our regulars. Mara, we've got some great Olympians in the laser. We've got Penny Clark and we've got Lily Zhu and we've got Lily's coach John. And I want to make sure that we're addressing starting for the smaller hiking boats as well. So if you want to drop a message in on the chat box. Oh dear, have we lost Nick? Maybe Nick isn't on the call anymore. That's a pity. It would be great to get his input on that. Let's get your...
He didn't want to give away his favourite start. Still using it in the J70.
Exactly. You're probably right. Yeah, which is not really on, Nick. I'm going to have to send you a message about that because we're all about caring and sharing in Road to Gold. But anyway, I'll get you another time. It's nice to have him around, even if for a short time. And he's got his whole program. He's got his five or six teammates in, I think it's a Melgus 32, all on the Road to Gold, all studying alongside him as well. So thank you very much, Nick, for showing such faith in Road to Gold. Let's see, Dominic's got a follow-up question. We haven't asked your first one yet, Dominic, on creating a gap to Lourdes, but how did it come that 49ers do several tacks on the start line in the last minute next to each other? Applicable rules change almost too fast. Well, maybe, Hamish, that is still associated with his previous question about creating space to Lourdes. So do you want to address that from a 49er perspective?
Yeah, I mean, the space to Lourdes is obviously key. And it doesn't want to be too much space because you're just inviting someone else in there. So you've really got to have eyes in the back of your head to ensure that you're not opening a gap for someone else to arrive in. And then you need to be able to defend that. If there is somebody trying to get in there, you need to be able to defend. And it's all about the timing into the start. So that space needs to be there when you want to pull a trigger. And it's the reason everybody's going up is, as you say, tacking up, is there's two options. You can either scully way upwind or crab the way to windward or up towards the race committee boat, but vigorous actions as you're allowed within the rule of the 49er. Or you can tack. And generally when someone tacks to windward, you know, you'll find immediately the boats to leeward will tack, as you said. And the reason they do that is that they're all trying to make their way. They're all trying to gain that space to leeward. And if the boat to windward's tacked and created a massive space, then what's going to happen is he'll just put his bow down and roll over that group to leeward. So that to defend their position after the start, they all need to go up and sit in the same order with the same space between them.
Okay. If anyone else wants to come in and address creating gaps to leeward for their particular type of boat, for example, John Emmett, if you want to come in, we'd love to hear that. So you're a radial world champion in your own right, just in case people don't know, and you coached Lily Zhu for the Olympic gold in 2012. So hi, John. Creating that gap to leeward in a laser, those kind of boats. Give us some tips on that.
Well, first of all, I'd say there's a lot of cliches, and the first one is you want to create a gap which is as big as possible that nobody else can fit in. That's the rule of thumb, which often means creating it late. That last 30 seconds, you've just got to be looking around like crazy. And people don't think so much in the laser about the timed run-up, because 80% hull speed actually feels like 100% hull speed. But that's really clear 10 seconds after the start for people who got the bow down and got up to full speed, because it takes a while to build that final little percentage. Now, the thing that you can do in the laser is you can actually go almost directly to windward. So if you back the sail so that the boat is going backwards and push the tiller away from you, the boat will actually go back, side, and then actually go up the line. And that's something which we've seen a lot in the past 3 to 4 years. I would say the standard rigs started doing it quite early. And then the radials, more and more people are doing it. And it feels just like the dance you see in the Niners where they do the double tack. We have people going forward, back, and then sliding up and tucking underneath each other. And yeah, I think the boat handling, the fleet, has just improved and improved, improved over the past few years.
And how much of that is down to just general improvement of the fleet and always looking for those marginal gains, and how much of it is down to any changes in the rules or the way that on the water judges are changing the way that they're ruling on these things?
Crikey, I'm waking for the first protest at the Olympics on the starting area, where people will tend to protest when they wouldn't protest at any other regatta. So I just saw, so my favourite start is at the pin end. I mean, I think it's really important not to have a favourite start, because then when you're under pressure, you are always tempted to go to your go-to default. And the thing I noticed with the Olympic class is it's not so much that the standard has gone up, and it is, it goes up ever higher, but there's just more and more depth. So before, there would be, you know, 3 or 4 people who were really quick in a condition, or they had really good boat handling in a condition. And you asked me a few years ago, you know, who did I think was medal potential for an Olympic Games? And I think I probably gave you about 10 names, which possibly wasn't what you were looking for, but that's where it was.
Yeah. And if you had to identify one or two names that you pick out today as really good at starting in the Olympic radial fleet and the Olympic standard fleet, which names come to mind?
I think one of the things you need to realise is it's quite condition dependent, because it's also what you're quite good at in terms of boat speed. And you get like a false positive there that if somebody's particularly fast in a condition, they won't necessarily push the start because they don't need to. And it's more important they get a result. And the other thing is the people who are good at starting and winning starts, it's also a higher risk strategy. So that actually they're more likely to have a very bad start occasionally as well. So probably in the radio, I'd say Anne-Marie is probably one of the later people to come in. And I see her winning a lot of pin-end starts. In the standard rigs, I'm not really aware of somebody, because there's so much depth in the fleet, I'm not really aware of, you know, a consistent person who's there. And it also changes the way people are sailing. So Elliot in Melbourne, he was under trials, so he was looking for a really consistent regatta, so he didn't push the starts on that occasion. And it's like Hamish said, there may be some venues that actually it's incredibly important to win the pin end, because that's the only way you want to go. So I don't see a really dominant starter, because there's just so much depth in the fleet.
John, thank you very much for that. We're beginning to run out of time, but I did start a little bit late. And Hamish, if you've still got a bit more time, we can run over a little bit if that's okay with you. I've got a question from Boris. Now, Boris, I haven't got the rest of your name here, but Boris, I have done some research for you. I spoke to Hamish the other day about which high school to go to in New Zealand, some names for sailing. So I'll get back to you personally about that and trying to help you out with that. Regarding starting, your question is about transits. Do you have any other way to know if you're on the line without a transit? So, we always want to know the secrets of where that dotted white line is that's invisible to us. So what are your best ways of doing that, Hamish?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting, you know, good question, and one of the things I've noticed is that you'll meet starters through the years of coaching and sailing with different people who rely heavily on transits, and that, you know, they're almost at the point of obsession. and spend a lot of their time, you know, thinking about that and trying to pick up a transit and remembering it's not an easy thing to use a transit, given what's going on the start line. So I think in saying that, Pete Burling is a good example of someone who never uses a transit. He wouldn't even bother getting a transit because in his mind, it's not the reason you get a good start. There's a lot of pitfalls with a transit. I think, in defense of the transit makers, Pete probably misses out on a few options every now and then, but it wouldn't be many. It would be under, in the class that we're doing, it'd be well under 5% that I would say, he would have been better with a transit, So it really is much more important to have a feeling of where you are on the line. And you with a transit, you don't really always get that option to see. It's pretty busy either side of you, and you don't get to use a transit often. And the other pitfall with a transit is it's likely that the current or the wind can move slightly and bring a mark in a different sort of, it just starts to go upwind suddenly, it'll just turn a little bit and it will get a little bit more under it. And it's like a yacht, it will start to tack, and generally marks are tacking against the current and they just move around a little bit, and the race committee boat as well can just move around a little bit. So I've seen a lot of people, with an OCS and a black flag go, but I was behind my transit, and they probably were, but the transit had moved. So there are pitfalls with transits, but I would say that I think I would be more reliant of all the good starting methods I've seen on watching, understanding where you are on the line, just as a feeling of where the fleet is, and watching what the fleet is doing, and making sure above all else that you're starting in the front row. And I think the only rider to that is knowing when a group has gone early and it's clear you're going to be seen. Otherwise your default is always to start in the front row and have a feeling of how to do that, an eyes feeling, a proportion of where you should sit around the boats to windward and leeward of you.
One of the exercises that we talk about in this chapter is starting on a long line and having those rolling 3-minute starts. And obviously you're gauging the people in your squad, how close to the line they're getting. How quickly do you see a rate of gain in terms of them improving their spatial awareness of where the line is?
It comes really quick. And, we're talking quite a long line. And, initially you'd see, it's hilarious when you're at the race committee boat and with the whistle in your hand and you've got the video and you're like, what are these, and that's like three or four boat lengths over, and you can see it, they can't. And then you always want to make sure the feedback comes straight away. And then it rolls on from there. And I definitely see, you always see big improvements from the first start you do like that to that, and the next, the last three or four, they'll just be totally aware. And when you debrief it, it's not because they've just suddenly found a transit, because as I said, Pete doesn't even use a transit.
So if you were wired for sound, and so if I had you, Hamish, in my ear and you were in the coach boat and you were calling me how far forward or back I am on the line, do you think you could even speed up on that process of the 3-minute rolling start exercise?
Yeah, possibly. I think 3 is good though, because you do always want to give your sailors time to sort of debrief it. Though it's always tempting to push on with drills and just keep going at a rate of knots to, bring as many things into your hour of sailing or 2 hours of sailing as you can, which I totally agree is a good idea, but you always do need to pause and digest. And I think 3 minutes is good. You need to say, okay, well, what could we have done better next time?
Well, meanwhile, I'm going to hold my hand up as transit dependent all my life. And I feel like I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, owning up to this great sin, because my world is caving in as I hear first that Pete Burling doesn't use transits. And now I see that Santi Langer also doesn't use transit. So I feel like we need to bring Santi back in to see what question he can provide for Boris on how to get off the start line without a transit. Come on, Santi. I don't think you're giving us the full story here.
No, it's true. It's true. I always hate transit. I just hate it. So I'm happy. That's why I type it to hear people.
It's leaving money on the table, surely. This is what I don't understand. Even if you don't use it, it's like an insurance policy. Why not take out that insurance policy?
Well, first of all, because I always had sight problems, so I don't see very well. And then I could never find a house in the land, then or the tree. Then I have kind of bad memory, or, you know, I don't trust my memory in that. And I try trust more my instinct. And I think also starting well is a lot about your relationship to the fleet. And I learned along the years to try to understand the shape of the fleet. So I ask my question like 20 seconds. You know, I am in this very long, you know, I come from the good old days that we started 100 boats. So you were there in the middle of the fleet. And I was asking my question, how long I am from the line? And I used to do a lot of exercise, as Hamish just said, and you get good at it, at the feeling. And when you do it alone, it's a lot harder. So if you are starting a regatta and you've been normally the day before the regatta and we want to have an easy day, if we are not 100% confident, we will do middle line starts to check our time and distance to the line. And you get good at it if you practice and practice. And then you, when you have the other boats, you see the B of the line if you are in the middle and you see the shape. And 30 seconds, I always ask my crew, I feel that we are 5 boat lengths behind you. Agree? Yes. And many times, for example, Ceci, in my case, is in charge of the transit. Yes, because she always done it. So we have a mix, but I don't dare to care, because as a helmsman, I feel I have a lot more to gain to focus on as we've been discussing now, to have a good space to leeward, making sure my time and distance is good, making sure I have an opportunity to tack and close the windward boat. I can do that tack, that double tack really good. And then it's easier for me to have a sight of how the fleet is developing. And then the other thing that I find very important, as we discussed, being in phase is important. So if we are not very well trained, we forget to look at the wind, you know, and 20 seconds, you need to keep following the shifts and all that. And there's so much going on at that last 30 seconds. You are, you know, it's hard to keep a boat close to irons. You know, they are at the very limit to close your, to give you those 50 centimeters that are gold. And looking at the wind in front, and if I have to look for a little house in the land, that would be too much for me.
That's a really interesting point. You can only be looking in so many places at once. And I know, as transit dependent as I am, I'm spending an awful lot of time looking under my boom to look for that little house all the time. But on the question of practice, Santi, you need to be as good as you can be on the start line of the Olympic Games in July 2021. And it will have been with extremely limited practice time. So coming back to Alan's question about training drills, when you've only got 2 boats to work with, how many boats do you have to work with in Argentina? And how are you replicating those start line scenarios without regatta practice?
Well, you nailed it. This is the reason why I'm here, because, you know, it's not necessary that we will learn new things here, but we will refresh our mind, only talking. And yes, we are going to have less competition. And I have a strong, you know, I was reading one of the papers you sent us. And yes, I am strong as Hamish. I feel like people do more regattas than needed. Actually, now I'm scared, because I think people are racing less and I'm training better. So it will be harder at Olympics. I think now is so interesting, because we need to brainstorm how we are going to change the way we train to get better with less competition and less watching at the good people. You know, you learn by watching people that have improved better than you. And now we don't have that because we don't have so much connection. And in our case right now, I decide to be alone this month. And I think it's strong to be alone, to be quiet, and to get away of the pressure you know, we are all competitors, beasts, and you get angry when you get beaten, or, you know, and you, in a certain way, you could lose your focus. So I wanted to be alone, quiet with Ceci here, and we want to train alone this match. And obviously, the exercise for the Nacra is quite a cool exercise, because you can put a long line, be in the middle, and then come back foiling in the dead zone angle, which is not comfortable. And that's a really good practice by itself.
So there's legitimate, good, useful practice you can do even by yourself. You don't even need another boat to do starting practice.
Absolutely. No, it's a lot harder. It's a lot harder by being alone, because the other boats give you reference. And I think alone is better. And yeah, in the Nacra also, not only for the start, in the Nacra, I think it's different from a laser, that is the fleet, as John said, is so deep, and they've been so many years of development. In the Nacra, I think we are sailing the boat at 80% of the potential of the boat. We are very bad sailors for the foiling Nacra, for sure. So training alone and being alone is still a good, you know, for me, again, going to the papers of Hamish, I think, you know, we need to be able to go along the course in 20 knots of breeze without making mistakes, and we can train that alone for sure.
Well, the standard goes up and up and up in such a new class as the Nacra. The standard, whoever was coming 20th in the fleet one year could probably be winning the fleet the following year. Such is the rate of improvement. What about training for creating that gap to leeward in a boat like a Nacra? How do you create that gap, and how do you train for creating that gap when you're training in Argentina?
Yes, for example, before we start, because now we don't have the pressure that we have a boat on the side, and we are not so worried about our trimming or things like that. So every time we stop to drink, then the next start will be a simulation of 10 seconds. So I call it, without even the watch, 10, 9, 8, and we train our procedure, how I hand the mainship to Ceci, and how I put the boat in the right angle. And even we do 360 turns to make sure to improve our skills to get the boat from very low speeds to high speeds. And so in those 10 seconds, I try to make sure to learn my skills to be able to be to have this boat as low as possible without going sideways, to have a good feeling of the grip. What's the minimum speed you can hold the boat, moving the less forward as possible and moving the less sideways as possible. And there is a lot to learn there for sure. And then from going from that three knots, very smooth, and says you have to be very aware of the jib to know when I need to turn the bow down to send it. And yeah, all that is critical, and we can train alone for sure.
Well, that's extremely inspiring. And if you can manage to get so much start training done by yourselves, I guess that doesn't leave any excuse for the rest of us. Santi, I'd love to have you along for some more of these calls. We wanted to get you along for the fitness call a few weeks ago, because it seems like you're redefining the what we thought were the age barriers. So we hope to get you back for your expertise and your observations on other aspects of Road to Gold. Thank you very much for all your input this week. And we send our best to Cecilia, and I hope she recovers from injury okay. And she's also, of course, very welcome to join us on these calls if she's run out of things to watch on Netflix. So please get her along as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think it was a really nice wind up to the session. Thank you, Santi. And you know, one of the things I can see from the outside, listening to you, is you take away that competitiveness with the, you know, if you're training with a group of boats, you are so competitive at that you may overlook certain parts of the drill that you want to learn better. If you're training alone, this is what I took away. I'm always learning too, so I'm listening to you. You know, if you take it away and go alone, you're able to do that particular part of the drill better because you're taking away that competitiveness where you might compromise certain aspects of your performance in order just to win that start or win that drill. So I think that's what I heard you saying, and I thought it was a really, really good bit of information. Thank you.
And I thought a great observation that must chime with you, Hamish, that Santi is concerned that other people aren't able to race because there's been this distraction for them all these years. And now they don't have that distraction of doing regattas that they're not battle ready for. They're actually going to be doing some proper training like they should be, like you're telling us we should be on the road to gold. So, yes.
That is a concern.
Anyway, if anyone was under the impression that you have to have won Olympic gold medal to come live on one of these calls, and that's absolutely not the case. But I hope that you've enjoyed having such expert input. But we really do encourage participation wherever you are on your own personal road to gold. It's been a really enjoyable session. And it's interesting now that we're getting into the decision-making phase of road to gold, Hamish. It just continues to get more and more exciting. Have you got any final observations or things you want to comment on before we sign off?
No, I think we'll leave the decision-making mystique alone for now. But yeah, I'm excited about this. Is the part that I, you know, feel personally is a favorite of mine. So yeah, these next few chapters will be a lot of fun.
Fantastic. Well, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you for all your input, all your questions. Please keep them coming. This time next week, we're going to be looking at tactics. So get your thinking caps on for the decision making that you make around the race course, the boat on boat stuff, the stuff where maybe you're having problems and you want us to help you out. So that's it for this evening or this morning, wherever you are. Have a great week on the water, Hamish, and have a great week the rest of you. Hope you're managing to get on the water, but if, like me, you're in lockdown, then I hope you're sort of living your life through road to gold. Thanks, good night, and see you in a week's time.
Thanks, Andy.